ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 1st chapter, text 29. Tasyam tu karichit shorir Vasudeva kritodvaha Devakya suryaya sardham Prayana rattam Translation. Some time ago, Vasudeva, who belonged to the demigod family or to the Shura dynasty, married Devaki. After the marriage, he mounted his chariot to return home with his newly married wife. So there is no purport, so I'm to read the next three verses also and purport. Kamsa, the son of King Ugrasena, in order to please his sister Devaki on the occasion of her marriage, took charge of the reins of the horses and became the chariot driver. He was surrounded by hundreds of golden chariots. Devaki's father, King Devaka, was very much affectionate to his daughter. Therefore, while she and her husband were leaving home, he gave her a dowry of 400 elephants nicely decorated with golden garlands. He also gave 10,000 horses, 1,800 chariots, and 200 very beautiful young maidservants, fully decorated with ornaments. Purport. The system of giving a dowry to one's daughter has existed in Vedic civilization for a very long time. Even today, following the same system, a father who has money will give his daughter an opulent dowry. A daughter would never inherit the property of her father, and therefore an affectionate father, during the marriage of his daughter, would give her as much as possible. A dowry, therefore, is never illegal according to the Vedic system. Here, of course, the gift offered as a dowry by Devaka to Devaki was not ordinary. Because Devaka was a king, he gave a dowry quite suitable to his royal position. Even an ordinary man, especially a high-class Brahmin, Kshatriya, or Vaishya, is supposed to give his daughter a liberal dowry. Immediately after the marriage, the daughter goes to her husband's house, and it is also a custom for the brother of the bride to accompany his sister and brother-in-law to exhibit affection for her. This system was followed by Kamsa. These are all old customs in the society of Varnashram Dharma, which is now wrongly designated as Hindu. These long-standing customs are nicely described here. So King Devaka, he gave his daughter a dowry, 400 elephants decorated with golden garlands, as well as 10,000 horses, 1,800 chariots, and 200 beautiful young maidservants who were also fully decorated with ornaments. So we can see that the society or civilization in these former times is very different from today's society. You can just imagine, even in the marriage of a very rich man's daughter can hardly imagine him giving to his daughter 200 elephants. What would she do with all those elephants? But still, the basic principle is still followed today as indicated by Srila Prabhupada, especially in Indian or what is called Hindu society. Father always gives a dowry to his daughter as much as possible. So here in the purport, Srila Prabhupada most significantly says that these are all old customs in the society of Varnashram Dharma, which is now wrongly designated as Hindu. Many times, just as when I was coming to Bombay from Vrindavan on the train, people ask me, "Oh, are you a Hindu?" It's a very common question. So I always hesitate to give an answer. Of course, we must preach according to the mentality of the persons we are preaching to. So this is the conception of people. Either you are a Hindu, a Muslim, Christian, or something else, Buddhist, Parsi, or a complete atheist. But of course, personally, I never think I am a Hindu. I never think that. And Srila Prabhupada has explained that although this is so common and so widely accepted, that this word Hindu is a misnomer. He explained that in Bhagavad Gita, in Srimad Bhagavatam, you will never find the word Hindu. Never. Of course, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, you can find the word Hindu. But why is that? Srila Prabhupada explained, the word Hindu was given by the Muslims. India was governed by the British for about 200 years. And then before that was governed by Mohammedans for over 1,000 years. So it is said that the Mohammedans, having come from the West, they originally said those who live beyond the Indus River are Hindus or Hindus, and that's the way the name came into being. But actually, the real understanding should be that instead of Hindu, this civilization is the followers of Varnashram Dharma society. The division of society into four social and four spiritual orders. But then still, if somebody asked me, "Are you a Hindu?" I would not say, "No, I am a follower of Varnashram." Of course, we answer, "I am Vaishnava." Srila Prabhupada, many times, especially in the later years, he spoke much about Varnashram Dharma. Not so much in the beginning, when he was establishing the Krishna consciousness movement. But in later years, after the Krishna consciousness movement was quite well established, he spoke much about Varnashram, and these conversations have been collected into a book also, Varnashram Conversations. It is often said that Srila Prabhupada said that half of my mission was accomplished, but half of my mission remains unfinished, the establishment of Varnashram. Actually, you cannot find this particular quotation in the Bhaktivedanta Veda base. Some people doubt whether Srila Prabhupada actually said it, but still it is a fact that Srila Prabhupada explained many, many times that it is essential for society to be divided into the four varnas and four ashrams. And he even, on a number of occasions, instructed that the ISKCON society should also divide its members according to the four varnas and four ashrams. Of course, ISKCON has always divided its members according to the four ashrams, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas, but not according to the four varnas. When Srila Prabhupada would say this, the devotees would question, but Srila Prabhupada, Vaishnava is transcendental to the four varnas. A Vaishnava is even beyond the position of an ordinary brahmana. And of course, Srila Prabhupada would say, yes, this is true. The devotee is in a transcendental position, but just for giving the example to the greater society, we should also divide our society in this way. But then sometimes Srila Prabhupada also said, if someone said, but a Vaishnava, he's transcendental even to the position of Brahman. Sometimes Prabhupada said, Vaishnava is not so cheap. So another thing, of course, well, the question is, why did Srila Prabhupada want society, or why did he insist that society should be divided according to the four varnas and four ashrams? Why did he consider that so important? Because the varnashram system is the fertile ground whereby one can gradually advance to the position of Krishna consciousness. Whereas the chaotic condition of society today is very unconducive for bringing one to Krishna consciousness. And that, of course, all of the devotees can appreciate very much. There is such a world of difference between life within the small compound of Radha Gopinath Temple and life outside. Life outside doesn't appear in any way to help bring one to Krishna consciousness. It only perhaps helps bring people to Krishna consciousness in one way. It is so horrible. It is such a struggle. It is such an absolute, disgusting existence that when one comes to the temple and associates with devotees, he or she can immediately appreciate the superior position of Krishna consciousness. So, Srila Prabhupada wanted that Varnashram be instituted. He even instructed that each temple should open a Varnashram college. This was never done. Actually, Prabhupada's instructions, the devotees heard them, his leading disciples on morning walks especially, heard his instructions and certainly considered them very carefully, but these were very hard for them to accept how they could be practically instituted. So here we're just beginning the story of Lord Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, Mathura, and Dwaraka, beginning with the marriage of Vasudeva and Devaki and Kamsa taking the reins of the chariot. It is explained here that Kamsa, in a previous life, he was the demon Kalanemi. So in some of the Puranas, it is explained by Prabhupada that Kamsa was the demon Kalanemi and was killed by Lord Vishnu. So in some of the Puranas, the pastime of how Lord Vishnu killed the great demon Kalanemi is portrayed. He was assisting the leader of the demons, Tarakasura. So in many of the Puranas, we get the stories of how persons came from here to here, who became the queens of Lord Krishna, who was Prahlad in a previous life, etc., etc. So in the Padma Purana, there is the story of how Kamsa became the son of Ugrasena. I will just narrate it briefly. That Ugrasena, descendant of the Yadu dynasty, ruling at Mathura, he had a wife named Padmavati. So the story of Padmavati is related by someone else as an illustration of why wife should always stay with a husband. Wife should not go even to stay with her parents. The story was given as an illustration that Padmavati, she was a very chaste wife and very beautiful, but after some time she was called by her father, who missed her very much. They had a very affectionate relationship. "Please come and stay with me for some time." So King Ugrasena, he allowed his wife Padmavati to go to her father's house. At that time, she met all of her old girlfriends, and they would often play so that she felt like she had regained her youth. So one time she was with many girls in a lake playing, and a demon named Gobila was flying overhead in his celestial chariot. And upon seeing the lustrous beauty of Padmavati, he became attracted and then overwhelmed by lust. So he was able to assume any form at will. By dint of his introspection, he could understand her identity as the wife of King Ugrasena. He assumed the form of Ugrasena and came to where Padmavati was and called her, "Come here, come here. I miss you so much. I want to enjoy with you in a secluded place." So she wondered, "How is it that my husband came here? How could he leave all of his royal duties? But anyway, I am his wife. I must obey him." So she came to him in a secluded place, and then he satisfied his desires with her. But there was a slight marking on his body, on King Ugrasena's body, she noticed was not on the demon Gobila's body. So therefore, she could understand this was not actually her husband, but someone impersonating him. So she prepared to curse him. The demon Gobila said, "Why are you blaming me? I am a demon associate of Kuvera. We demons, it is our nature to kidnap the wives of others and take away the wealth of others. We are created by the creator, Brahma, for the purpose of finding any fault in a Brahmin's execution of his religious duties and then destroy his religious performances and religious principles. Why are you finding fault with me?" So, Padmavati went back to her husband, who was very happy to receive her. But she was pregnant from her connection with the demon Gobila. So she tried many means, taking herbs to induce a miscarriage. But all of them failed. Finally, the fetus within her womb spoke to her, "Why are you trying to kill me? Every living entity is awarded a certain duration of life according to his past pious and impious activities." So, after hearing this, she gave up the idea of trying to kill her embryo. He further said, "You should know I am not just an ordinary person. I am the demon Kalanemi who was formerly killed by Lord Vishnu. Now I am appearing in the hopes of gaining revenge." So the child was born, and this was Kamsa. Kamsa is described in many places as being huge and immensely powerful, causing fear even to the chief demigods. So all these things are hard to imagine by today's standards. And as I said initially, that by today's standards, we can hardly imagine how a father would give so many elephants, horses, chariots, and maid servants in charity. So in the Krishna consciousness movement, of course, there's the attempt to change society from modern chaotic society and reintroduce Vedic society. But it is my feeling that sometimes people, are devotees, are too eager to abruptly introduce things as they were long ago. Certainly the change would have to come gradually, not abruptly. An example which I often think about and like to give is that in Vedic society, a girl is married at a very young age. Even Prabhupada said that he was married, his wife was 11 years old. And he gives the example that his sister, when she attained puberty and was not married, only perhaps 12 or 13 years old, Prabhupada's mother went to his father and complained, "This is a great shame. Your daughter has already attained the age of puberty and she is not married. If you don't get her married quickly, I will throw myself in the Ganga." So this is only, of course, little more than 100 years ago. But sometimes in ISKCON, trying to too abruptly introduce these principles, girls at a very young age were forced to get married with disastrous results. Therefore, the Acharya, he applies the principles of religion according to time, place, and circumstances. That is his expertise. Just like Srila Prabhupada, he went to America, he did many things which were unheard of, but which were very practical for the establishment of the Krishna consciousness movement. When I first came to India, 1972, and went to Calcutta, at that time all of the pujaris were women, five. So Srila Prabhupada was criticized for this and for many other things by caste-conscious Brahmins and others. But the Varnashram Dharma, as explained in the Shastra, it may be introduced in the greater society, but only gradually, gradually, gradually. The important thing is that a society's customs are based ultimately upon philosophical understandings. The Vedic society is based upon a view of life which is gradually lost and which is not understood at all in countries outside of India. Vedic society has an understanding that the living entity is not the material body. That this life of 60, 70, 80 years is not all in all. That I have been fortunate to come to the human form of life. After going through so many lower births, I have now come to the human form of life. This is my chance to purify my existence by following religious principles and thereby elevate myself to a higher position. Of course, in the Vedic literatures, there is much, in many places, emphasis on elevating oneself to the heavenly planets. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Trigunya Vishaya Beda, Nistrigunya Bhavarjuna. The Vedas mainly deal with the three modes of material nature, but Arjuna, you must rise above the three modes. So, of course, the Krishna consciousness movement is not simply a movement for reestablishing the Varnashram social system. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was touring South India after accepting the renounced order of life, he was wandering, chanting, and dancing in ecstasy. It is described in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. He didn't even know the direction. But still, he was guided. He finally came to the shore of the Godavari River. When he had gone to Jagannath Puri, he had converted Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. And before his leaving to go on his tour of pilgrimage of South India, the Bhattacharya insisted, you must meet Ramananda Roy, the governor of Madras. You must meet him. He is an exceptional devotee, an exceptional person. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to the shore of the Godavari River and sat down. And just then, Ramananda Roy came there It is described he had an entourage of more than 1,000 persons, Brahmins, musicians, and others. He came there to bathe. So, when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw Ramananda Rai, he immediately became mad after meeting him. And when Ramananda Rai saw Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared more luminous than 100 suns, he also became very eager to meet him. Actually, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna himself, and Ramananda Rai is described as an incarnation of the gopi Bishakha. So they met and embraced in great ecstasy, but then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu controlled his ecstasies because the stereotype Brahmins were thinking, how is this? Ramananda Rai is Shudra by caste. How is this sannyasi feeling ecstasy by embracing him? And Ramananda Rai is a very grave personality. How has he become restless like a madman while embracing this sannyasi? So, of course, Vaishnavera Kriya Mudra Vigena Bhujai. Ordinary people, they cannot understand the activities and mood of Vaishnavas. It is simply not possible. So then they sat down to talk, and it was agreed they would meet in the evening. In the evening, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also sat waiting, and Ramananda Rai came with just one servant. And they went and they sat in a secluded place. So they wanted to engage in talks. So the format was that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he asked questions, and Ramananda Rai gave the answers. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he requested Ramananda Rai, please recite a verse from Shastra which indicates life's ultimate goal. So they didn't engage in frivolous conversation like, oh, you're from Puri. What's the weather like there now? Or, you know my brother-in-law, so-and-so there? Did you see his wife? How many children does she have now? Immediately came to a very meaningful point. So Ramananda Rai recited a verse from the Vishnu Purana, Varna Shrama Charavata Purushena Prapuman, that the Supreme Lord can only be satisfied by the execution of one's duties in the varnashram system. And there is no other means for satisfying the Lord. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, all right, that's okay, but this is external. Please tell me something more. So in response, Ramananda Rai recited one verse after another after another. These were also rejected by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as being external until Ramananda recited a prayer of Lord Brahma from the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where it is said that one can remain in whatever position he is in, but he must hear with a pure desire to attain perfect understanding and to engage in devotional service. One must hear from a self-realized soul. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted this as the basic principle for further advancement. But then he wanted to hear more and more. Even when Ramananda Roy spoke about devotional service in servitude, in friendship, and in parental affection, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, this is all right, but I want to hear something better than this. It was only when Ramananda Roy came to the platform of discussing the conjugal relationship of the gopis headed by Srimati Radharani with Krishna that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu became satisfied, and their conversation continued on this basis. He said, it is for this only that I came here to see you. So this Krishna consciousness movement is bringing us to a very exalted platform, not at all ordinary. But still, Srila Prabhupada warned again and again, don't become sahajya. Sahajya means those who take everything too cheaply. Don't just think you can hear the pastimes of Krishna and the gopis without first assimilating thoroughly the Bhagavad Gita and then the first nine cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this was a common tendency even in Prabhupada's time, that many devotees, they become impatient. Go out and make life members, distribute books, attend Mangalarti. What about all these confidential topics of Krishna's dealing with the gopis? That's where the real nectar is. So in Prabhupada's time, there is in Los Angeles, at that time it was very big temple, world headquarters, a group of devotees got together just to discuss Gopi Bhav, became known as the Gopi Bhav movement. So when this was brought to Prabhupada's attention, he very strongly curtailed this tendency. So the Vedic system, as I was saying, the Vedic system was based on the thorough understanding that the living entity is not the material body, that it is by good fortune we have attained the human form of life. Now is the chance to engage in following religious principles, to come to a higher platform. And of course, those who are transcendentalists know that the human form of life is not simply meant to go to a higher material existence, but a tato brahma jigyasa. Now we must inquire about the ultimate truth, and that is described in Bhagavatam. The ultimate truth is known in three features: Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti, Shabdete. So the devotees, of course, are just interested in reestablishing their forgotten, dormant relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. And everything is going on very nicely under the direction of Srila Prabhupada and his predecessor spiritual masters. But what about the society out there? How would it ever be transformed? I was living in ISKCON from 1970 to 1986, and then I left to live independently. I went to Goa. And at that time, of course, living in the temples for so many years, very kind of sheltered existence. And when we would go out, we would just go out to make life members or go to programs at devotees' houses or life members' houses. Then being quite away from ISKCON and looking at society, I thought, at this greater society, I don't see any influence of Prabhupada's teachings. They don't have the slightest clue. Then how could this be? How could Prabhupada's teachings enter the world stage or enter the minds of people? How could this be done? Of course, when Prabhupada went to America, America, more than India, is without any tinge of understanding of even the basic principles of Krishna consciousness. In India, there is still the residual remnants of the Vedic civilization. You go around, you see Radha's bar and grill, you see Sri Krishna tires, or something like this. Actually, a devotee, Rasaraj of the Bhaktivedanta Institute, he told me an interesting story in this regard, that he knew one woman. She was working in a big company, but one night she, in her sleep, she saw the Yamadutas come and they took her to the presence of Yamaraj. And then Yamaraj, or maybe Chitragupta, who has the account records, said, "No, no, her duration of life is not finished. You have made a mistake. Take her back." So they brought her back. But after that experience, she was not feeling well. She didn't go to office. So the next day, she went to office, and the boss, "Why, you didn't come yesterday?" So she said, "In my sleep, I was taken to the abode of Yamaraj." But the Yamaraj told his servants, "No, you have made a mistake. So I was brought back and I wasn't feeling well." So the boss said, "Oh, okay, okay." So Rasaraj was giving this an example of how, even though now society is really so divorced from Vedic civilization, but still, there is some residual remnants there that the person accepted. "Oh, okay." Whereas, say, in America, if someone gave an excuse like that, of course it would never be accepted. Because it is said that before Kali Yuga, the demigods would come to the earth. And you read in the ancient literatures, the demigods coming, people being very accustomed to seeing the demigods or the Gandharvas or this or that. Whereas now, Prabhupada explains, the demigods would not come to the earth even to pass stool because the earth has become such a nasty place. So after thinking about how could greater society... Of course, when Prabhupada went to America, Krishna consciousness did make an impact so that everyone soon knew about Hare Krishna, because all the devotees, they went out every day, chanted Sankirtan in the public places. So Hare Krishna became a household word. Everyone knew, though, "Oh, there's a Hare Krishna." So in that way. But as far as reestablishing Varnashram system, after thinking about this a lot, I concluded the first step would be when the intelligent people in the greater society become convinced that this body is not the self, that life did not evolve from matter. Even in India now, our education is just a mirror of American education or Western education, which is guided by the scientists who have convinced most educated, intelligent people that this body is the self, that life evolved from chemicals, that long ago there was a Big Bang. The universe expanded, the gases cooled the earth, and the sun formed. The earth was covered by water. chemicals gradually, molecules formed within the primordial soup of the Earth's water-covered surface, and by chance interaction, the first single cell somehow formed, and then by mutation, this, that, the water receded. Some primitive creatures crawled onto the land, and after billions of years, now you are all seated here. So this was called by the members of the Bhaktivedanta Institute a molecular fairy tale. And actually, from our position of a little enlightenment by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, it seems absurd, actually. And when Swarup Damodar, he once went to a meeting of a very big Nobel laureate who proposed this theory that life evolved from chemicals, and he said, if I give you the chemicals, can you make life? And the scientist admitted, well, no, I cannot do now. Then when Prabhupada heard of that, he was very pleased. Yes, we should challenge them. That is very good. He would again and again say, and our Swarup Damodar, he challenged, if I give you the chemicals, can you make life? No, I'm sorry, I cannot. So I feel that this should be one of the activities of our Krishna consciousness preaching. Prabhupada, I feel, formed the Bhaktivedanta Institute for this purpose. And he was very, very enthusiastic. You see, in the last year and two years, whenever he got the chance, we would call for Swarup Damodar and have lengthy discussions with him, especially how to defeat this theory that life evolved from matter, chemicals. So it can be proven logically that the self is not the body. It is not logical that conscious life evolved from non-conscious dead matter. So if somehow this were vigorously preached and the leading intelligent people of society became convinced, so much so that it even became part of the educational system, that people were taught this Vedic understanding, then gradually the emphasis from, if I'm this body and this life is all in all, life, my life is finished when the body dies, then of course the goal of life is money, and then enjoy bodily gratification. But if the understanding can be imparted, body is not the self, life is eternal, this human life is the juncture that allows us to go to a higher platform, then perhaps society can turn away from this mad pursuit to a more sane, simple living and high thinking. All right, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you, Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.